You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Hello, friends. I'm Rosie Acosta, your host and guide on this journey to self-discovery and radical love. I've walked a path filled with challenges. Growing up in East LA during the 92 LA riots, it left me searching for meaning, for mentors, for a way to truly understand the purpose of life. But you know what I found? The power of conversation. As a first-gen Mexican American, these conversations became my compass, offering insight, support, and an endless amount of inspiration. So I decided to create a space where we can share these conversations with you, our community. And that's how the Radically Loved podcast was born. Join me as we dive into topics like mindfulness, spirituality, self-love, and the keys to overall healthy living. I'm joined by my dear friend, fellow author, producer, and teacher, Tessa Tovar.
Hi, I'm Tessa, and I'm grateful to be part of this community because it teaches me so much about what it means to be human. Ever since I was a little one, I was always asking my dad the deeper questions in life. Why are we here? What happens when we are gone? What is the purpose of life? I love this show because I get to ask the questions that cut right to the meaning of life. I've learned that no matter how much we want the path to be clear or straightforward, it rarely is. And that is actually part of the beauty that creates a radically loved life.
Please do us a favor, share the episodes you love with your friends, and leave us a review. Together, we'll learn how to create a life that's truly, deeply, radically loved. Let's begin. Hello, everybody. Hello. Hello.
Hello. Is anybody out there?
Is anybody out there?
How are you?
Oh, my goodness. So good. Everybody, welcome back to the Radically Loved podcast. We have a very special guest today.
We do. I'm so excited for this. I'm so excited for this episode.
I know.
Dr. Neff.
Yes.
Spoiler. Dr. Neff.
What?
Dr. Neff is going to be on the show. I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Neff, but she is seminal in the field of self-compassion. I mean, if you've heard of Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, which I'm sure you have if you're listening to the podcast regularly, we talk about them all the time. Sharon Salzberg's been on here. I had my major fangirl moment where I basically froze. I mean, Dr. Neff is there in the same par.
Yeah.
Tara Brach, all that. Like, she's insanely smart, so passionate and hilarious. I just love her.
She and so relatable, so down to earth, and so brilliant in so many ways. She's the associate professor of human development and culture, educational psychology department at the University of Texas at Austin. She's written several books, my favorite one being Self-Compassion. She has so many accolades to celebrate. And, you know, her work has really transformed so many lives, mine and Tessa's included. And we're so excited to have her on the show today to talk about self-compassion, to talk about her new book, and to just answer some of our questions.
Enjoy the interview. Well, here we are. I'm so excited for
Dr. Neff. Yes.
Dr. Neff, how are you?
I'm great. Really happy to be with you both.
We have been so looking forward to this episode. Kristen, I can't tell you how, I'm sure you get this all the time, but your work is so seminal. And for me, it's been so important. And lately I've been reading the Fierce Self-Compassion. I believe that's an older work. And I'm super excited to hear about the book that's coming out in September of 2024. But it's just also timely, especially right now. I mean, I was having this conversation yesterday with my partner about how angry I was and just feeling myself getting riled up about the state of the world and trying to like reconcile that with, you know, me as being a yoga teacher and wanting to be compassionate with others, but it really has to start with ourselves. So that's a long rambling way to, I guess my first question is, can we define self-compassion?
Yeah. So if you start with the term compassion, you know, passion means to suffer, come is with. So it's really just, how are we with the difficult stuff? How do we show up for emotional or mental pain? And normally we think of it as, how do we show up for other people when they're suffering or in pain? And so this is just really, how do we show up for ourselves? You know, and also, so that's one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it in the field of psychology is defined as the desire to alleviate suffering. So not only are we present with the pain, we also want to help in some way. There's a sense of care and concern. And so sometimes the way we help is through acceptance, which I like to call tender self-compassion. We accept ourselves. We accept the fact that life's imperfect. Sometimes difficult things happen. But there's also what you mentioned, fierce self-compassion, which is how we alleviate suffering through taking action, which might mean saying no, speaking up, political protest, drawing boundaries, you know, meeting our needs or motivating change. And so there's a lot of different ways that compassion can manifest, but it's all really the same goal, which is to alleviate suffering.
So I'm curious if you wouldn't mind, Kristen, sharing a bit about your journey and what led you to focus on the study of self-compassion.
Yeah, well, for me, it was a personal journey, and it still is a personal journey primarily. It was my last year of graduate school, and I was finishing up my PhD, and I was not in a good place. I had gotten married young, and I had gotten divorced young, and I was feeling like a bit of a failure at relationships. And also, I was under a lot of stress about, I mean, I thought I probably would get my PhD, but the jobs were very, very few and far between. And I thought, oh my God, how am I going to earn a living? I'll be overqualified, la, la, la. So I was stressed. And I had heard that mindfulness meditation was supposed to be good for stress. So I actually took a course in mindfulness meditation. And fortunately for me, it was taught in the tradition of a teacher named Thich Nhat Hanh, who's one of the teachers who always talked a lot about self-compassion. So the first night I went, the woman leading the course said, hey, you know, not only should you have compassion for others, it's really important that you're compassionate toward yourself if you're going through a hard time, which I was. And so it was really interesting because it took a while to figure out meditation. It took actually a few months to figure out how to do it. But it was I remember it to this moment. I went home that night And I just started speaking to myself in a kinder way. I said things like, okay, Kristen, you know, yes, you got divorced. You're feeling bad about yourself, but it happens to a lot of people. You did your best. Does it mean you're a bad person? You know, and then yes, you're stressed, but I'm here for you. Something will work out. It's, you know, I care about you. I just started talking to myself like I would to a good friend. And like immediately it became easier to bear. It's not like the problems went away, but it went from being like overwhelming to feeling like, oh, I can work with this. And so I thought, this stuff works, right? And then when I finally did get a job at the University of Texas at Austin, I decided to try to research it, which, you know, I certainly didn't invent the idea, but it hadn't really been researched before in academia. So that was over 20 years ago, and now there's over 7,000 studies, so it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and I feel like you definitely, I would say that your work has propelled a lot of those findings and people's work and, you know, their desire to continue to learn more about self-compassion and compassion in general and the efficacy of compassion in our daily lives. I remember listening to self-compassion. I do volunteer work for a prison rehabilitation project. Yeah. And I remember you wrote about a story, you know, you gave us the reader a sort of scenario where we can sort of have the preconceived notion of a person and our judgment arises, you know, with you know, like almost so instinctively of like somebody committed a crime, it's an automatic you're a terrible person. But then mm-hmm. once you uncover background and story and context and, you know, potentially a lot of the times in my experience, there's a lot of abuse that has happened to this person. And again, not to say that atones for, you know, the action or that you, the way I like to say it is it doesn't mean that you co-sign the behavior or the crime. It just allows you the context to understand people in a more deeper way. And I really love that I was listening to you talk about that as I was driving to the prison. And so I was hoping that you could give us a little bit more context around that sort of framing.
Yeah. And thank you. It's such an important point. You know, you can think of it as the complex web of context and conditions in which our actions arise. And what you said is very important. We can judge behaviors or actions as unhelpful or even wrong, but it doesn't mean that the people, the human beings, you know, who are like the source of these actions are bad. Right? So we're all kind of in some ways at some level doing the best we can with what's been given us. We have different brain wiring. We have different histories. We have different upbringing. We have different cultural conditions. We have different immediate conditions, like are we stressed? Are we addicted to some substance? There are a million factors that influence how we act. And so this is both compassion for others and ourselves, right? Often with ourselves, we just think, oh, it's because I'm bad. Well, in fact, what happened is there's all these other factors that led to you as acting as you did. And so absolutely, we need to say this behavior is not good. We need to try to stop it. That's the fear self-compassion. Fear self-compassion is more aimed at harmful behaviors or situations, standing up to them, saying, no, it's got to change. But the tender self-compassion is aimed at the person, again, whether it's yourself or other people, and understanding that our unconditional value as human beings, you know, we don't have to go to graduate school to be worthy of compassion. The moment a baby is born, you know, it takes its first breath, it's like, oh, we have this natural desire to want to care for that infant, because there's something intrinsically valuable about human life. And that's where our source of compassion comes. And then, you know, what happens after that? Again, we have a lot less control than we might like to think we do, you know? So we got to like cut ourselves some slack. Again, it doesn't mean that we don't try to make behavioral improvements. Of course we do. It doesn't mean we accept bad behavior. Of course we don't. we can accept people. And that's what self-compassion is. It's a source of unconditional worth. And this is really important because, in my early work, I really made a big contrast between self-compassion and self-esteem. So the word esteem, like an estimation, a judgment of worth. Self-esteem, or whether or not we judge others, comes from all these criteria. Are you special and above average? You know, have you performed? Have you done the right things? Do people like you? Are you attractive or am I attractive? And those types of judgments can cause a lot of pain, especially if we feel we don't measure up. So what self-compassion gives us is our sense of self-worth is unconditional. It's like the baseline. We are unconditionally worthy. And then we can use our resources to try to make sure that, you know, our actions are as healthy and as possible. And actually, this is the cool thing. When you know you're unconditionally worthy, it allows you to learn from your failures. When your worth is predicated on succeeding and not failing, you are not going to want to admit it. You're going to try to blame other people. You're going to try to weasel out of it. You can do everything you possibly can not to acknowledge that you failed or made a mistake because it's so painful. So believe it or not, you know, Carl Rogers years ago said, the curious paradox is that the more I accept myself, the more I can change. And that's what happens with self-compassion. And you can, you know, going back to your example, Rosie, of someone else who maybe has had a hard time, is in prison, the more we can give those people unconditional acceptance as human beings, so they have that support and that idea that someone believes in them and feels they're worthy, yeah, the more they will be able to change as well. If we judge them and say you're bad and you're worthless, you know, it just makes it so much more difficult.
Yeah. And what's interesting in that is the fact that people don't realize, I didn't realize how many of those, I call them kids, right? They're adults, but the program that I work with specifically for men and women who are serving life sentences for crimes they committed under the age of 18. Wow. And so there is that extra element of, you know, like some of these people never had anybody believe in them, never had anybody show up for them, never had anybody ask them how they are, how they feel. Like it is astonishing the amount of, you know, the statistics of how many people we work with, hundreds of men and women that all sort of have that same storyline. So I want to just say that what you're saying is so absolutely true. And we forget the power of just having that deep sense of caring for another person and how special and how powerful that is just for all of us.
Well, and the beautiful thing about self-compassion is if you don't happen to be fortunate enough to have a lot of those people in your life, which would be, it's great if you do, you actually can learn to give that to yourself. You can actually learn to give yourself the unconditional love that maybe no one else has given you. You know, you can learn to show up for yourself and support yourself, even if other people, you know, aren't doing as what we acting as we'd hope they would. And when we do that, again, that the beautiful thing is when we start to understand, like, you know, think about your worst habit. Did you really choose to have the habit? If you could snap your fingers and have that habit go away, wouldn't you? Right? There's so many reasons why we have these behaviors that aren't very helpful that go way beyond our ability to just say, okay, I won't do it anymore. You know, and so that's why we need to have self-compassion. And again, the more we can give ourselves unconditional acceptance as human beings worthy of kindness, care, and support, the easier it is. And you don't have to believe me, there's a lot of research that shows this. The easier it is to actually make positive changes for the better. It fosters the ability to learn and grow once we take the whole self-esteem thing out of the equation.
Yeah. Could you share with us and our listeners what that looks like? Like, what does self-compassion in practice look like?
Yeah. So really there are so many different ways we can practice self-compassion. And if you think about, again, the really good context is compassion for others. Most of us hopefully have some good friends in our lives, and a good friendship is kind of defined by this reciprocal compassion. You know, we show up for our friends, they show up for us. That's why they're our friends. And so we might have compassion for our friends by saying something, you know, just like saying words of encouragement or offering our help in some way. Sometimes it's just listening and not saying anything. Sometimes it's just demonstrating that we care by like putting a hand on their shoulder. Right? It's really just the communication of care. And this is really important, a sense of connectedness. I mean, what's the difference between having pity for someone and having compassion for them? We don't like it when people pity us because we feel like we're separate from them. They're looking down on us. We really like it when people say, oh, hey, I've been there. I totally get it. You know, it's like, this is human. And so there's really three elements. There's the mindfulness, which is the showing up for, being with, and I can just listen to my friend or I can listen to myself. There's this sense of common humanity, which I call it, which is understanding that, you know, all people struggle. We've all been there. You know, yeah, of course, people have very different experiences. I don't want to say that it's all the same. But to be human does not mean to be perfect. To be human means to be imperfect. That's like the definition. This is a state of imperfection that we all are born into. And then the kindness and the warmth. You know, whether the, again, there's so many ways to convey kindness and warmth. Singing. Believe it or not, some people like, you know, like their mother sang to them when they were little kids and they might like sing themselves a hum a little song. So listening to music, going in nature, there's a million different ways to show that kindness and support. We like to say, or at least I like to say that self-compassion is really asking yourself the question, what do I need right now to be well? And the answer to that question is very varied, very varied. Mm-hmm. I can see.
Yeah. I love that. What resonated with me so much was listening to you talk about an experience you had with a mother towards your son. I'll kind of paraphrase what happened in the end. It was like you reacted in a way that maybe you would have originally shamed yourself for. I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it ended up being, it sounded to me like the end result was you had this moment where you might have connected with this other woman. And it sounded like you were able to acknowledge, I'm really angry right now. And it sounded like, yeah, she was able to acknowledge too, well, I'm really angry right now too. And that resonated with me so much in the way that, like,
yeah, I think I don't. So it was someone. It was actually the show with my son, who's autistic, and he was being disruptive. She gave him this look, and, you know, talk about mama bear. I like to call it fierce compassion, like mama bear energy. And yeah, it's not like we want to be careful with it, and it can harm. If you harm people, it's not very helpful. But that mama bear energy, when it's the protection of harm, is actually very useful. So mama bear rose and I called her a name and I got really angry. But yeah, but my ability, and it helped through my practice, to say, I am so angry right now. And she was like, yeah, tell me something I don't know. I don't think she was, she was where I was. But it allowed me to like de-escalate and, you know, not have it go any further. I'll be honest, reactive anger is something I struggle with. It's just some people are wired differently. I have a short fuse. I'm a very passionate person. And one of the things I explore in the book is that passion means like I'm really passionate about self-compassion. And that's why I'm so driven. But it also means sometimes I react in a way that, you know, ideally I would be a little more considered in my thoughts and language. And so I've had, you know, I'm not coming at self-compassion from the position of someone who's perfect and got all their stuff together. I'm coming at it from someone who's very imperfect. It's how does a very imperfect, flawed person with some behaviors and habits, which, again, if I could snap my fingers, that would have been gone long ago, and it's still here. You know, how do you work with that with compassion?
Yeah.
And it's a slow process. And, you know, it's just like day by day, and you just fall off that wagon and you get yourself back up again. But it does help. Here's the thing. What really changes is, instead of just saying, oh, I overreacted, I'm a bad reactive person, you know, and by the way, shame still arises. This is interesting. Shame is a natural evolved emotion. It's actually built into our physiology. It evolves so that we feel the shame when we did something that pissed off the fellow group members, and it was protective because they might kick us out and then we die because we need others to survive. So it's just part of a natural physiological reaction. So I still have shame arise. So a feeling of shame arises. But what happens is instead of like believing it or buying into the story of it or telling the story about myself, like I'm a bad person, like, la, la, la. It's just like, oh, I feel the shame. Oh, and I feel compassion for myself for feeling the shame. And it's like, you know, so I'm very good at apologizing and like, well, yeah, this is just the human experience. We all have things that, you know, patterns, and not that I still don't do work on it. I do. But you know, I've really come to, I may be like this when I'm 90. There's no guarantee, and that's okay. You know, again, I try not to make it other people's problems. If I can, occasionally I make it someone else's problem and then I apologize. But here's the thing about self-compassion. And I try to say this to the people I teach. It's really important. It's less about what happens and more about how do you relate to what happens. And first of all, we don't have a lot of control over what happens. We have some influence. We can do a little work, but a lot of it is just beyond us. But how do we relate to what happens? Can we relate with kindness? Can we be present with us, with ourselves and others? You know, can we feel connected to the larger whole? And I've had experiences that have been really difficult, really painful, and compassion arises. And I'm actually, most of my awareness is filled with the compassion and just a little bit is focused on what's happening. And the predominant experience of compassion is a positive one. And then when we feel love in our hearts, when we feel kindness and care, when we feel connected, there's kind of this like a humility when just honor. Yeah, I'm just an imperfect human being. I'm doing the best I can. And there's something so connecting about that. And that's actually a really satisfying experience. Here's a saying you'll probably like. I have lots of sayings, which is the goal of practice is simply to be a compassionate mess. Talk about this in my books. You know, and yes, no, the goal is not to be a mess. The goal is when the mess of life arises, your goal is to be compassionate toward that mess. And pretty soon the compassion starts being more important than the mess. Mm-hmm. And that's something we can always do. That's a box we can check no matter what happens. We can always have compassion for the mess. Mm-hmm. Not being a mess, good luck with that one.
Well, I think that's why that story resonated with me so much, Kristen, because I think, you know, I was trying to put myself in your shoes, and I've definitely been there where I react in a way that I'm like, oh, I would want to shame myself for saying something like that out loud to another person. And it seemed like you said, you were able to diffuse it by naming it and also in that simultaneous moment have some self-compassion for the situation that it's imperfectly human. It's just imperfectly human. So I think about that in terms of what I love about your work is talking about, you know, yeah, this isn't going to be a perfect process. It's not going to be a linear timeline, and we're all going to face challenges and we're all going to face barriers to creating this practice in our daily life. So I think it's important to acknowledge those moments that are like, oh, this could be a barrier. This could be a challenge. Well, so what happens when that stuff comes up? What do we do with it? And how do we continue to practice self-compassion in those moments, you know, right? Isn't that kind of the idea or the goal?
Yeah, I mean, and it's really more of a means than an end. It's not like we finally get to the end, this mind state, and we're compassionate and we're only feeling compassion and everything's going swimmingly. It's more this process of, okay, you aren't self-compassionate. Can you have compassion for that? You know, be aware, okay, you know, so that didn't go so well, or let's say you continue to judge yourself, then can you have compassion for the pain of that? So compassion, I think it's really helpful to break it down to the three components. I argue that there are three main components, and I like it because it's really kind of instructions of how to have compassion. One part, mindfulness, is just being aware that there's pain here. So for instance, having compassion for the fact that you're self-critical. Okay, feel the pain of the self-criticism. One part, common humanity. You aren't alone. And not only are you not alone, this is like the way the human brain actually evolved to be self-critical, because it goes into a threat defense response. Most people are self-critical. There's nothing wrong with you for being self-critical. This is the human experience, and that helps you feel connected to others. And then one part kindness, you know, it's like, oh, so my son, for instance, we gave him a little script when he gets self-critical, which is tricky brain. I know you're trying to keep me safe, but it's just really not helping right now. Can we think of another way to do this? You know, it's like tricky brain. It's like so sweet. Like,
I love brain, that so you know? Much.
It's like, yeah. So that's the way his brain, you know, even though he's the daughter of like the guru of self-compassion, his brain and all brains, but I think maybe especially his brain because the autism and some other stuff he's got going on. When we feel threatened, you go into fight, flight, or freeze mode. We fight ourselves with criticism. We flee into a sense of shame and isolation. And we freeze and we perseverate and get stuck. That's the way the brain evolved. So we can have compassion for that, you know?
Mm. It is a practice.
I was just going to say. I think the other thing that I find most interesting is how shame gets wrapped up into all of these practices, you know, that the shame that we feel for having those human experiences and how somehow we feel like perhaps we're not great self-compassion or compassion practitioners because, you know, it's like Tessa, you know, she teaches yoga and meditation. I'm a meditation teacher, you know. We're supposed to have everything figured out and be non-reactive. And I find that that is not the case.
Yeah.
And there is a little bit of shame around that as well. Like, oh, I should, you know, we start shitting all over ourselves. Like, I should have my life figured out as a meditation teacher. But yeah. For me also, the fact that I don't is also really beautiful to be able to accept the fact that I'm human. And it's okay for me to have human emotions and to still be a little bit reactive.
Yeah, that's why I'm so grateful I'm a self-compassion teacher, not a mindfulness teacher. It's a little more leeway, you know?
Maybe I need to change my vocation.
Yeah. No, absolutely. That, you know, giving yourself some grace. Giving yourself some slack. Again, and some, you know, part of us hears that and says, giving yourself some grace. Well, that means I'm going to be complacent. Mm-hmm. This is a really cool thing. The research shows it's the exact opposite. The more you can accept yourself unconditionally and give yourself some permission to be human, the easier it is to learn from our setbacks and failures, and the easier it is to grow. The more we shame ourselves and we think that that's going to actually help us change and grow. It does the opposite. It just makes it harder because not only do we have to figure out how to change and grow, we're also dealing with the anxiety and the feelings of shame and all these negative emotions, which just get in the way. So it's like a child, you know, we can unconditionally love our children at the same time that we don't want them to do behaviors that are harmful or, you know, we want to make sure they're potty trained by the time they're 10, if we can help it, you know, of course we do. And we do whatever we can to help our children learn and go, but it's not contingent. Our love isn't contingent on their success. Hopefully. I mean, some parents, they do have that sort of contingent love and it messes people up. And so hopefully we can not do that with ourselves.
Yeah. Hopefully. Hopefully we can have compassion when we do it to ourselves.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask one or two last questions, Kristen, before we let you go. I was doing some reading about you and I'm familiar with your work, but I know you have a self-compassion community. So I wanted to hear a little bit about that. And also, I'd love to hear you discuss what inspired you to write your latest book, Mindful Self-Compassion for Burnout.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So two love projects of mine. So this year I started something called the Self-Compassion Community. This is another way for people to learn self-compassion. So it is a community. It's a membership community. And, you know, there's scholarships, so we don't turn anyone away for lack of funds. But basically, we gather. So I have gatherings once a month where people can ask me questions. I have gatherings with guests, people like, you know, Rick Hansen, Dan Siegel, Tara Brock. There are small group mentor sessions where people can talk with each other, led by a mentor who can answer their questions about self-compassion practice. then also a lot of cool things, like I recorded a whole bunch of new self-compassion practices for community members, and I've got learning videos, and it's really a little world. And so right now it's mainly my voice, but I'm starting to bring in other voices. Like, I just had someone who's an expert on self-compassion for couples. So I'm going to have her, you know, do a little workshop about how to apply it for couples. So I really want it to be this hub, this center for all things self-compassion. So I'm very excited about that. And then the other thing that's happening that's very exciting is I co-wrote with my colleague, Chris Germer, a book on mindful self-compassion for burnout. Because burnout's everywhere. After the pandemic, especially, people are just at the end of their rope. And self-compassion is very good for dealing with the symptoms of burnout, dealing with the feelings of exhaustion, of incompetence. People often blame themselves for being burnt out. They think they shouldn't be burnt out. And what happens with burnout is people stop caring a little less. You know, it's like when you just can't feel like you can't do it anymore, we just shut down and become numb as a way of coping. And so opening our hearts to ourselves through self-compassion is a very useful way to keep ourselves in that state of care. And so again, there's a lot of research showing that self-compassion helps prevent burnout and also helps people recover from burnout. So you got lots of practices. No, nothing that takes a long time. People who are burnt out do not need homework or more things in their to-do list. They're all stuff you can do on the spot, like on the job in the middle of your busy day, to bring compassion to yourself.
Mm, so excited for that. Thank you. So final question I have is, because I think it's really easy, you know, we consume these podcasts in the self-help realm, we read books, and it's like, okay, yeah, I'm so excited, and I'm going to start this new journey and project, and it's a lifelong work. So my last question is, what one piece of advice would you give our listeners who are struggling right now with being kind to themselves?
Yeah, so the good news is you already know how to be kind and compassionate. It's part of your nature, part of your evolved nature, and also what you've learned in terms of being a friend or a family member. So really all you need to do is just ask yourself at any moment, what would I say or how would I treat a good friend who is struggling with the same situation I'm struggling with, whatever it is. And then you know what to say. So it might seem really foreign to you. It might seem really difficult, but it's actually pretty easy. The two things are remembering to do it. So you've got to remind yourself one way or another, and giving yourself permission to do it. And then once you give yourself permission and you see it's not going to make you lazy or complacent or selfish, it's actually going to help you a lot to be strong in your life, then it comes more easily.
Mm, I love that. Such a great reminder. I always like to picture a puppy because I'm a dog lover. So I think, how would I talk to my puppy about this?
Perfect.
Right? Yes.
Exactly.
So, okay, final logistical question.
Oh, my goodness. This is the best. This is the juiciest of the questions.
Oh, well, I wonder if I'm asking the one you're thinking of.
You are.
Where can people go to find out more and connect with you? And, you know, where do you like to connect with people?
That's the easy one. Just Google self-compassion, you'll find me, or you can go to selfcompassion.org. I got in early, so it's very, I've got good
SEO,
the search engine. Yeah, exactly. So my website's really the best place to start. You can take the self-compassion scale to find out your level of self-compassion. I have free practices that you can just download or listen to see if you like the practice of it. I've got blogs, I have videos, I've got a ton of stuff on there. So that's really the best and easiest place to start.
Yeah, thank you so much. And we're going to make sure that all of those links get into our show notes. So you can just click the info button below, show more info, and you'll see all of those amazing, beautiful ways to connect with Kristen. Kristen, thank you so much for your good work. It really is so helpful, and you shine such a bright light in the world. So thank you for showing up and doing what you do.
Yes, we're such huge fans. And as I said earlier, like, I've been following your work as well for a very long time. And as a meditation and mindfulness teacher, I can't think of a practice that I use more of than what you've taught and what you've created. I will continue to be a student for the rest of my life, I like to say. So I thank you from the depths of my heart so much for your work.
Thank you. It means a lot to me. Appreciate it.
Please remember.
And you can keep on doing your good work as well.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead, Tessa.
That's okay. No. I just would like to remind y'all to remember to subscribe, rate, and review on your platform of choice. And don't forget to check out our YouTube channel. You can see our faces, watch our fun expressions, and follow along with our journey that way as well. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
Hey friends, thank you so much for listening to the Radically Love podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. Also, don't forget to check out the Mindful Love Hub on Substack. This episode was produced by Tessa Tovar, music by DJ Taz Rashid.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.